Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today, well, it's a first for Bookmark. It's a couple, a married couple, Judy and Adrian Reith. They're here to talk about their book, Act Three, The Art of Growing Older. We'll also hear from Kate Swindlehurst talking about her book, The Tango Effect, on how dancing tango helped alleviate her symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And we'll have a listen to some of the winning entries in the Rock Road Library Limerick Writing Competition and learn about the challenges of writing a limerick. But as I say, our feature guests on Bookmark today, Judy and Adrian Reith. Hello, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi. Nice to have you here. You're not quite here because we're still in lockdown at the moment, so this is all virtually, but lovely to see you.
It's great to be with you, yeah.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but as I say, this is a first for Bookmark, having a married couple. And you've been married how many years?
30 years and 6 months, I suppose.
Yes, 30 and a half.
30 and a half years.
And how did you meet, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, through mutual friends, really.
I knew your sister.
Yeah.
I still know your sister.
And we had lots and lots of friends that we still have as very good friends that we both knew independently before we met.
This was down in North London at the time. I'd actually been married before, so I was sort of coming out of that. And then Adrian was unmarried. And and we realised we had a lot in common. And I think some of that is still true, although we've developed separate interests as life has gone on.
And how was it writing this book together? Because working together and being married, they don't always go together, do they?
No, some people cross-examined us about that. But actually, it was a really nice experience. I really enjoyed it. It was very productive. And when I read the book now, I can't tell who wrote what bits.
And you've been very open in the book about your relationship as well.
Yeah, well, we thought it was only fair. This is a book which is trying to be honest, or getting people to be honest with themselves about themselves. So we thought we've got to deal likewise. Any marriage is not straightforward in 30 years. And so we're happy to say where we've sought help with ours, and it's worked, yeah.
And that was a positive thing to do rather than out of crisis or any major difficulty. It was recognising we'd reached a big crossroads. Our kids had grown up and left home, and, you know, not everybody has children or the empty nest thing to deal with. But it was a big thing for us, and our lives work-wise were changing as well. So we decided to seek help to look at the time coming our way and how could we make it better, looking at our strengths, looking at the challenges and how to deal with them, rather than seeing it as any kind of catastrophe, because it wasn't that. But we felt it was important to see where we could make things better, and it was very useful.
And then there's one very important part of the book where we talk about the fact that you service your car and your boiler, but when do people actually regularly service their relationship? And it struck us that this is something that needs to go into the book.
I'm looking forward to talking to you about the book, but we'll hear your first choice of music now. Is music important to you?
Hugely important for me, yes. In an alternative life, I think I would have been a musician, probably.
It's always been in the house, and I had a few years where I actually worked in the music business when I was much younger, but that was in the wardrobe area. But our kids have all had musical instruments played, enjoyed. There's usually music on in the house as well, so I'd say we are a family that needs it.
And this track, When I'm 64, by the Beatles, why have you chosen this one?
Well, I'm only going to be 64 for another couple of weeks, so I thought I'd better play it while I can.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now.
That was When I'm 64 by the Beatles, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guests, Judy and Adrian Reith. Judy's previous books include Be a Great Mum, A Practical Guide to Confident Motherhood, and Seven Secrets of Raising Girls Every Parent Must Know. Act 3, The Art of Growing Older, written together with Adrian, was published earlier this year. Brian Eno, no less, described it as inspiring, intelligent and provocative, but also unexpectedly comforting. And Simon Mayo called it inspiring. It's very inspiring, I must say, and very practical too, which is a word that I think should be described to it. And you've been honest throughout that this is a self-help book.
Yes, and I know that some people don't like that term, but as coaches for many years, we are skilled and we wanted to share those ideas about how people can take what problems they might have. So not really heavy, serious problems like you might have to address in therapy, but where are you now? Where are you going to get to as these Act 3 years go by? And what we mean by Act 3 is really 50, 60, 70s, possibly into your 80s. But while you've still got a choice and some opportunities and a time never seen before in history of good health and expectations. So that's what all this is about, really. And we wanted to include in the book lots of stories of people doing great things in those decades, but it needed a bit more than that. It needed some steerage, really, to help the reader figure out how to take the stories and their own ideas to make a plan.
And this isn't an anti-aging book, is it? This is about celebrating and building on what you've got.
Yeah, it's the opposite of an anti-aging book. I think it is about embracing it, because we've got this extra chapter really in our lives which perhaps our grandparents didn't get. I didn't ever see my father or my mother run anywhere. They didn't do any sort of exercise where they got out of breath. But our generation is different. You know, we've got so much more potential. So we thought we'd write about that.
Yes, you said the intention of the Act 3 book is also to live life without regrets.
Definitely. And we quote a lady in there who wrote a book about the regrets of the dying. She was a hospice worker. So some people are motivated by, oh, I better do something before it gets too late. And the one truth in Act 3 is that you never know when that moment might come. We've all been to funerals of people who've left us too soon, particularly now as we're in the coronavirus times. But it's important to sometimes think, what do I really want my life to look like while I still can? And if it's too scary to think all the way through to the end of your life, think about maybe the next 5 years and work backwards from that and make your goals and plans according to your values and perhaps your purpose and things that you've always wanted to do but perhaps never thought you could or should.
And what characterises Act 3? You talked about age, but is it more than that? Is it about a set of other circumstances?
Yeah, it's perhaps more of a stage than an age. If Act 1 is leaving your child age and moving into independence, then Act 2 is establishing maybe a life and a career and maybe a family. But Act 3 is the bit that happens after that, that's before you start to decline health-wise. So we don't like the word retirement very much, and I think it's actually increasingly irrelevant as a word to a lot of people, because they want to be doing active things. So we've called it Act 3 as this extra act. Life used to be a three-act play. Now we would say it's a four-act play with this third act added in.
It's recognising what it takes to move from one stage of life into the next, and how that can, if you're not careful, be governed by fear and also by loss, you know, whether it's your waistline and your glasses or whether it's the loss of your kids living under the same roof or your status at work. We do definitely in the book address how to deal with those big themes as well that will come your way. It's not just a glossy book full of shiny stories. It's a very real book in which honesty is very important, and being real about your feelings as you're getting older and you're facing up to these things that are changing.
And there are more opportunities, as you said before, for people older. I mean, I remember when my mum got to 60, that was it really. You know, she sat and she knitted and watched her TV for the rest of her life. There wasn't an awful lot of other options, in fairness, or if they were there, she didn't go looking for them.
That's
different
right
now.
Yeah, it is different. And I think that it is partly, as you say, about a mindset of, if you're not thinking there are any options for me, then I'm not going to be doing anything else. You know, I'm not going to be missing or imagining anything else. But our generation, you know, the generation that Beatles, Paul McCartney and co. kicked off, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s, we've had the scales fall from our eyes. Everything has changed in our mindset. It's time to address that. This book is not really about saying, you know, go on cruises or wild holidays or spend lots of money. It's actually really about, you know, looking inside a little bit without being too navel-gazing and maximising what potential you have, I suppose.
And your map to this, the ideas that you talk about, they're embodied in the tree that's in the book, which is a diagram and an image. Before we look at the tree and what's on it, where did that come from? Did you have that before?
As coaches, we often use metaphor to help people unlock what they really want and how they're going to make their decisions and plans going forward. And we really like the idea of a tree. And it's a timeless image as well. We've written the book in such a way as well that it is in bite-sized chunks. It's not a big, fat academic tome that people would find too dense or difficult necessarily. It's very, very practical and very hands-on.
It's a book that you might have and look at for a bit and then set down and come back. And people have said they're already reading it in that kind of a way. Certain chapters might be more relevant to people at different times. So that's absolutely fine. We wanted it to be really useful. It's a working book.
And tell me about the tree then. Describe the tree, because that is really the centre of the book, isn't it?
Yeah, what struck us about a tree is there's the bits you see, that most of us see, aren't the most important bits. The trunk and the branches are not the most fundamental part. The fundamental part, literally, is the roots. That's the thing that holds that tree up when the storm is blowing and feeds the tree through the trunk to the branches. So we wanted, as Judy said, for it to be really memorable. And so the four roots are the thing that we want people to remember most of all. And they are the most important thing, we think, in Act Three. And they are attitude, values, your sense of purpose, and your key relationships.
And when they are working well for you, then they hold up the whole of the rest of the tree. And where that is the health in your life. So mostly to do with your physical health in the trunk. And then the branches are the things that fill up our time each day. So work, money issues, our housing, worries about the world.
What's interesting is that in the workshop, people would come along a bit more concerned about their money or their health in Act Three. And we would say, actually, there's more important things to think about. And those are those four roots, because we know people who have no money or not very much money who are happy and peaceful in themselves and fulfilled. And we know people whose health is not very good and are the same. We want people to zoom out and to think, the really important things are those four roots.
And it starts with attitude, because there's a lot of research about how a positive attitude can make even the bleakest situations improve for you. And it was reading Viktor Frankl's book on Man's Search for Meaning, and he noticed that people who had a more positive attitude in the death camps in the Second World War were way more likely to survive. One of our case studies, we talked to a guy who had a terrible cancer diagnosis. He asked the oncology nurse what would help him the most, and she said, attitude, every time. And he really, really strived hard to maintain a positive attitude through all the worst bits of chemotherapy, and he is still alive.
He observed that people who had a bad attitude, who said the needle is always too sharp and the seat is always too hard and the staff were getting everything wrong in their view, those were the people that didn't survive.
If you think of the first root as attitude and then the next one is purpose, which for the first time in perhaps all of your life, you finally might be able to say, why am I here? What is my contribution and my legacy to this world, to my family and to myself? And then how you go about that is your values. So it's important to be kind, maybe, or to make a contribution.
I think the important thing is to appraise what really are your values, rather than ones you've inherited from parents or other people or other circumstances.
Or shoulding, as we call it.
Yes, stop shoulding me is what we sometimes say to each other, which is about that, really. It's how you go about doing what you do. It's got to come from a better place than should.
But the key relationships has to be in that root structure as well, because the people who are having a better go at Act Three tend to have a more even understanding of their key relationships. It doesn't have to be spouses or husbands and wives or anything like that. It could be your relationship with your parents, your children, a close friend, your work colleagues, where things are really in trouble, or better still, in a good place, and then they'll help hold up your tree.
Well, thank you. We'll come back to those key questions in just a moment. We're about to hear from Kate Swindlehurst, who's talking about the power of dance. And you talk in your book, actually, about the power of play and the power of dance.
Yes, it's something, again, that we've perhaps got a gift in Act Three, where maybe our working lives are diminishing a little bit. So time, which many of us complain about, we never have enough of, it is a chance to play and to lose yourself in those things that maybe you haven't done since you were a little child, where you wouldn't notice the time passing. And certainly dancing is a great one to be able to do that. In our health chapter, dancing is one of those things as well that's a good thing to do, because it stimulates the mind, it's good for all sorts of parts of the body, and it's sociable.
Kate Swindlehurst was formerly writer-in-residence at Cambridge University Botanic Garden and produced a short story collection, Writing the Garden, based on her time there. Her novel, The Station Master, won the 2017 Adventures in Fiction Spotlight competition and was shortlisted for the Caledonia Novel Award. The Tango Effect was published earlier this year. Set over the course of a year, it's a true and personal account of the restorative and transformative effect that dancing tango had on Kate's symptoms of Parkinson's disease.
When I was diagnosed, I had already been dancing tango off and on for a couple of years, but I had been finding it increasingly difficult, really. I had been generally wobbly in life, and I'd been falling over when I was running and so on. After diagnosis, first of all, I think I tried to fight it, as many people do. You know, I wasn't going to let this condition beat me. And I kind of wanted to prove that I was as good as I had been before. But gradually, exhaustion set in and the condition kind of upped its ante, really. And I began to give up. So rediscovering tango, it felt like a new lease of life somehow. What really struck me was the way that the intensity of the communication between two dancers, the unspoken communication, because tango is improvised, you haven't got a set pattern of steps to follow. So you figure out what to do as a result of the unspoken connection between the two bodies. They just felt a little short of a miracle, really. The wobbles that I was experiencing off the dance floor just vanished as I walked onto the floor. It felt like medicine. It felt as though it was a kind of an injection of dopamine, really. So I had more energy. I could stride confidently. I could change direction. I could even initiate movement as well as respond to it. Physically, it made a huge difference. And what seemed remarkable, really, was that difference extended beyond the dance. My energy levels and my stability were better off the dance floor as well as on. There's certainly evidence, research that looks at the effects of exercise on the brain and suggests that what we used to think of as a fixed entity, you know, the brain that you were born with, you had for life, we're increasingly finding out that you can do things to change it and that the brain is more plastic than we thought, is more malleable. And there was one quite early study with mice which showed that mice running on a treadmill, poor mice, the exercise bathed parts of their brain with a kind of protective layer. There is evidence to suggest that exercise of a particular kind can have a direct and lasting impact on the brain. There are several step patterns in tango which mimic rehabilitation exercises designed for people with Parkinson's. So, for example, stepping over a partner's foot changes in rhythm. Stepping with the heel first rather than with a flat foot or with the toe first. These are aspects of the dance which impact directly on the physical experience of the condition. What's unique about Argentine tango, particularly if it's danced in close embrace, which is the kind of pure Argentine tango, if you like, the intensity of the relationship between the two partners. Milonga is a three-dimensional word, actually. It's the name of the hall where you have a tango event, and by extension it also comes to mean the event itself. So a milonga is a social afternoon or evening of dancing. It's also the name of a related type of dance which has a different beat and a sort of fast pace. In Cambridge, if I go to milonga on a Tuesday night, it's basically 3.5 hours of dancing. People often think, you know, I go to a class, like a Zumba class or something, for an hour, but a milonga is not a class. A milonga is just an opportunity to dance. You find a partner by eye contact, what they call the mirada, they're looking round. So there's no walking up to somebody and saying, you know, do you fancy a spin round the floor? And the idea is that you lock eyes across the crowded room, a nod that would secure you your partner. And the pattern is that you dance 3 or 4 songs together with one partner, and then you clear the floor and have another partner for the next dance. It's not really acceptable to dance with the same partner for a whole evening. Thinking of one partner in particular, when I dance with him, we walk onto the floor and we won't start dancing immediately, but we will stand in the embrace and listen to the music and breathe. And you kind of wait to get into a sort of rhythm before you even move. Sounds a bit sort of airy-fairy, really, but once you feel that connection, then, you know, in an ideal world, you move together. It's just something quite remarkable, quite special. The norm is still that the man is the leader and the woman is the follower. In practice, there are quite a few up-and-coming female leaders now. In the same way that, you know, if you're having a conversation, it would be ridiculous if you asked me a question and I ignored what you said, but just kind of carried on speaking what I was going to speak anyway. And similarly in the dance, you know, if a leader proposes something without speaking and I don't get it and I do something different, then my partner will have to respond to that. So, you know, it is always a process of negotiation. When I was writing it, it seemed essential, I suppose. Coming up to publication, I felt really very anxious about it. But it wasn't so much the exposure as I worried that people wouldn't like it, really. And a few people have said to me, you know, it is very brave. And I don't really know if it's brave. It just seemed important, I think, to be honest. You know, I didn't want it to be a book about the exercises or the dances you can do to help yourself feel better. I wanted it to be an account of, I don't like the word patient, but the account of a sort of a patient's experience, you know, the whole of it. Not just the kind of physical impact of the dance, but the whole thing. Going back to those first lessons with John, I felt Parkinson's was central to the relationship and the classes and so on. And actually, I was special because of that. There are a couple of appendices, and the second one is a poem by a dancer and a poet called Ray, who called it Tremulous, and he describes dancing with me as a kind of liberation, because any wobbles on his part become secondary to mine. I think the people who dance with me now kind of embrace the Parkinson's rather than trying to minimize it. It has felt less like a sort of life sentence, really, and more like something to work with. Because, you know, I suppose we all have difficulties and limitations and things we don't like about ourselves and things that we wish were different. But it's enabled me to be open, more open about it. For years, I felt it was something I had to hide. It felt embarrassing, and I don't feel like that anymore.
Tango Effect by Kate Swindlehurst is published by Unbound. Judy and Adrian Reith are our featured guests on Bookmark today. In your book, you have a whole chapter written by a doctor as well.
We're not health experts ourselves, so we felt that the chapter on health should be written by somebody who had plenty of experience. And we were able to ask Professor Richard Vincent, who's the Emeritus Professor at Brighton and Sussex Medical School. But more than that, he's very interested in all kinds of things that help make people feel better. So not just drugs and diagnoses, but actually he believes that in the end, many of us actually know in our heart of hearts what is wrong with us. So we really liked his approach, and it was very important that we found a doctor who could write Act 3 health ideas and issues and practices in the same kind of tone as the rest of our book. So friendly, accessible, easy to remember, and quite light touch here and there as well. I think, you know, a lot of people are fairly aware these days that they know they should be doing exercise. They know that they've got to eat a few less calories, but it's good to have it pointed out in a more clear and accurate way.
And you don't shy away from big questions in the book about our own mortality and addressing that, what's going to happen towards the end and afterwards.
If it's a book about this end of our lives, mortality looms larger and larger. It's been particularly interesting that in this time of lockdown, people are saying, yeah, I'm all of a sudden much more interested in things like my values and what do I want to happen at the end of my life, those kinds of questions. So we absolutely didn't want to dodge that, because I suppose our work, you know, as coaches is about encouraging someone to be honest with themselves. And then if once you're starting to be honest with yourself, you need to be honest with other people as well. And it's a two-way street, and then families involved.
The last chapter actually is on death, funnily enough, and it's about how to have a good death with some really good examples of people who have done some planning. Even though it's painful, there's probably going to be somebody in tears at any point in those conversations. It is so good to have had that out and made something in writing so that when you die, your loved ones have a much easier ride of trying to make all the practical arrangements and knowing that they've actually had that conversation while you still could.
Thank you. Well, let's go to your second choice of music now, which is U2, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Why have you chosen this one?
They're my favourite band, but also in Act 3, it is that time where perhaps you do ask those kind of questions. I still haven't really found what I'm looking for in my life. I've never felt able to. I've got too many responsibilities, or I've always wanted to be a writer or a dancer or a scientist or raise pigs, whatever it is, and I just have that itchiness that needs scratching before it's too late. So that song is all about that, is keep looking, and this is the moment in life where you may really at last find it.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guests on Bookmark today are Judy and Adrian Reith, talking about their book Act 3, The Art of Growing Older. It seems to me, Judy and Adrian, this book, it's about asking ourselves those really big questions, isn't it? But sometimes drilling down into things we take for granted, really, asking people to question what a home is for, why are they working? That's big stuff.
It's huge stuff, really, if you describe it like that. One of our main goals was to not make it feel like big stuff, actually, in the book. There's quite a number of cartoons and little exercises in the book in order to ease the reader into a more enjoyable way of looking at that stuff. We've tried to make it, I hope, a little bit playful. It's not undermining the seriousness of the intent of the book. My old job was an advertising man, and people aren't going to listen to your advert if it's not entertaining. It's got to be engaging in some way. So we wanted the book to be like that, but to take them to a place where they think about the important stuff. Some people, I think about those things quite a lot, but other people don't think about those things at all. So it was that weird challenge of trying to bring those things together into a book that was readable, yet in some ways, well, I'm not sure I'd use the word profound. It might be a bit portentous, but it is important stuff for people. Yeah.
In lockdown, we've been doing a live Zoom once a week. What people are saying who are watching the Zoom is that you're helping me to think about big things, but in a lighthearted way. That generated a big sigh of relief for us, because when we were writing the book, we wanted three things. We wanted it to be a useful book. We wanted people to love it and to share it. And they won't share it if they don't love it and find it useful. So when we get comments back like that, that really makes our hearts sing, because as coaches, you're very used to asking heavy questions, meaning of life type questions. But there's a lot of people out there that we're realizing they're starved of that opportunity, but it doesn't mean that they don't need it as well, but it's the access to it, and in a way that works for them.
And I think the way to be able to ask those questions is by having a rapport. If you establish a rapport and a trust, someone begins to go, oh, I can talk to this person, and when they ask me a more challenging question, I can handle that, and it's okay to be honest about the answer. We were trying to do the same thing in print by approaching the same issue from a number of different angles, as Judy says, in a fairly light way in some ways, but not dodging death, making wills, illness, those kinds of things. What is your purpose? who are your key relationships? These are not small questions. And we do encourage people all the way through the book to take care. For example, the beginning of the chapter on key relationships, we say to people, take care, because we know for some people it's going to trigger a bunch of stuff which is going to be quite painful. And we want those people to look after themselves while they're reading the book. And that thought is something that we use a number of different times. But that doesn't mean to say you shouldn't be asking those questions. You know, you wouldn't want someone to get to the end of their life and think, why did no one ever challenge me about this or that or the other thing? You know, why did they give me such an easy time?
It is a very practical book, very easy to read. And the stories all the way through make it feel very real. These are real stories. These are truthful experiences of people.
Yes, well over 30 different people. And we tried hard to make the variety as great as we could in terms of age, stage, circumstances. But, you know, everything from the couple who in their late 50s adopted three small children once their own kids had left home to the Yikes. To the man who ended up being a dancer full time in his 60s, and people who survived very difficult things. There's a very moving story of a man whose wife was dying, and she ended up placing an ad in Guardian Soulmates to help him find his next wife.
Yeah,
which again was an incredibly brave thing on both of their parts, actually.
And another lovely story of a woman whose husband had died, and she wrote from the perspective of about 5 years later, and she said, I've realized that astonishingly all the people I know really, really well now are people that he didn't know. So she had made a whole new community of really good friends, and so there is life after death for her in that sense.
Half of our readers are female, so we look at the menopause and stories around that as well. It is a little bit written from a medical point of view, the biological changes that we might experience, but stories always tell things in a way better format than just theory. It was where it all kicked off for us, really, was realizing that we did have already within the wider circles we knew people who were doing really quite interesting things. Even here in Cambridge, the guy who didn't really want to be a retired academic, but he'd been making nice pots for years in a studio in his garden, and he ended up opening a cafe in Cambridge with his son. And if you go there, you get your milk poured by a jug made by him. So oh, some delightful stories, and these people are following their purpose, and it's giving them that sense of peace and contentment and happiness.
Well, thank you, Judy and Adrian. Let's listen to some stories of a different kind now, really. The Friends of Rock Road Library's Limerick competition came to a conclusion this year with the publication of the winning and shortlisted limericks about Cambridge, written by both adults and children. Before lockdown, I visited the library to meet some of those involved with the competition and learn more about the challenges of writing this poetic form.
Cambridge, a town to delight, boasts many a marvellous sight. But the strangest I've seen down beside Jesus Green is a cyclist stop at a red light. My name's Glenn Dakin, and the competition was my idea when I was the writer in residence at Rock Road Library. I wanted to do something that would get people writing, but that wouldn't put them off, wouldn't be too much like hard work. And I think once you get the bug of inventing limericks and rhyming, it kind of stays with you a bit. So I thought some people might give them a little start at being poets, maybe, but in a kind of cheerful, light-hearted sort of way.
It's like a worm that gets in your head. You know, I was dreaming limericks for a week, and in the end I had to send in the five that I'd written and said, please take these and don't respond, otherwise the worm won't be killed off in my head. So my name's Martin Roach. I live in Cambridge, retired. For my creative side, I now and again write little verses, limericks, or sometimes even something longer. Cambridge place names can tease, Gogmagog does not flow with ease. In Bennett and Magdalen, some letters are dawdling, and please explain Gonville and Keys. Actually, I showed this winning entry to my children and they scoffed because I read it to them and they needed to see it written down to see that when you see Bennett and Magdalen, it's actually Magdalen, for instance, is obviously written Magdalene. And similarly with Gonville and Keys, it's written down Chaos. But that's the role of children, is to scoff at their parents. Am I a fan of limericks? Yes, I think in a way, because you can write one within about 10 minutes if you put your mind to it, I'm a kind of a doer sort of person. So therefore, writing a book like others have done is a strategic effort, whereas I'm more of a tactical person.
Writing limericks is actually extremely hard. You know, it's a very tight rhyming scheme. You have to introduce a subject and there has to be a payoff, but it mustn't be completely obvious. But the idea was that if everyone wrote a limerick about Cambridge, it could be about a person they admired, like Stephen Hawking, or it could be about something that they liked about Cambridge life or something that annoyed them. I thought when you put all these limericks together, it would create a picture of Cambridge life, which would be completely different to any other picture you would get of it.
There was once a place, Parker's Peace, where reality often did cease. When up rose the fog, every person or dog disappeared despite nearby police. My name is Mbalia Salas, and I was asked to help judge the Rock Road Library competition. It was great fun, and limericks are lots of fun to read, and I could see how hard people had worked to work within the format and find humorous and pithy things to say. It's definitely a challenging format. It has very strict rules and must rhyme and fit that format. It did definitely put people through their paces.
So I was just looking for limericks that worked and that put a smile on your face, you know. And that. Also, it's quite nice when people use rhymes that aren't the most famous rhymes in the world, you know, so they use one of their own or something unexpected. So I guess I was looking for that.
I'd seen Magdalene pronounced as Maudlin, obviously, many times in Cambridge, and I thought there was something in there. It was luckily when they said the limericks had to be about Cambridge, that one sprang to mind, and then it was a case of finding other examples that would fit in to the rest of the lines. At one time, Allegius was in it. There's an Allegius Street, or Allegaeus, you see, I didn't even know how to pronounce it. So there were one or two that were dismissed. And actually, with limericks, I tend to find that they go through several edits. So it probably started as something very different and ended up at this.
The people of old Cambridge town repeatedly feel they're let down. Growth's a pain in the arse when planning's a farce. No wonder we all wear a frown. I'm Kay Blaney, and I was the writer in residence. I was asked to be a judge for this particular competition, which I thought was a nice change from the previous 2 years, which was the short stories, which was for children predominantly. This really was all out to young people and adults, and many adults gave it a go, which was great.
The standard was amazing as ever. I helped judge last year as well, and it was interesting to see the comparisons in this sort of work. Some brilliant entries and lots of poems about Cambridge, particularly about the traffic, I noticed. Is the traffic a bit of an issue in Cambridge? I guess so.
There's lots of famous people who have written limericks over the years and included them in novels and joke books and things. You can still come across them. I must admit, I had a little look around, Googled around at some limericks while I was doing this. And there is quite a rich and amusing form of poem that people, like I say, Michael Palin wrote a book of limericks. I think that was probably about 10 years ago now. It's something people turn their hand to.
I like funny poems. I like Wendy Cope. I won't pretend to be an expert in limericks. There was once a lady is the way they seem to begin, as far as I can remember. I'm not a great expert in limericks, but they can be very fun to read when they're clever.
Getting the flow is one thing, because it's very easy to actually make one line into two, and it's obviously a very precise construction. So as long as I edit it back to what a true limerick is like, then it works.
Definitely a challenging form, yes. I think you definitely need to kind of say it out loud, and often writers write their piece and don't always read it back. But I think with certain poetry, and particularly limericks, you need to hear it.
Well, given that the format is prescriptive, I was looking for the ability to work within that, so to follow the rhyme and the rules and the structures of limerick as far as possible, but also some wit and humour, definitely. So it's not just words thrown into a mound that just happen to fit, but ones that actually make some sort of sense, even if it's absurd sense.
James Watson, long after the Beagle, joined Crick in the bar of the Eagle. While downing a beer, he announced the new theory of what makes a seagull a seagull. I'm Stephen Swift, and I was just a contributor. I got a certain affection for Rock Road Library and try and help when I can. Yeah, I heard they were doing the limerick competition and thought I'd have a little go. I mean, really what happened here was I left it and left it and left it, and I was supposed to be doing my tax day before, and this was a good displacement activity, and I got a bit carried away. I ended up with about five or six on the go and not able to finish any of them, so I suppose in that sense not easy, but you just jumble them around and they kind of evolve. Yeah, there's all sorts of things, town gown, case of trying to poke a little bit of fun where you can.
what's really nice about when we were judging them is how people had played with various areas of Cambridge. Being a townie, but also having embraced the gown recently, I really like the town and gown connections, but more could be explored with that. I think that could be a further piece of work with the limericks. Get some gown people writing and town people, and perhaps about the opposite sides, not the areas that they're in.
I wasn't sure whether they would make them all too clean, what with it being a kind of a nice community publication. And I think there's a case for limericks being a bit rude.
A limerick is really based on its punchy last line, its surprise ending, ideally. So I would probably start with the end and work backwards. So where do you want to be at the end? What funny little quip do you want? And then make everything fall in around it.
If it's not going to rhyme in the right form, it might be because the wrong word has been used, because it's about the syllables as well in the word. So I often find when I'm writing limericks is to clap the syllables, which really supports the writing. They're definitely short stories. I think that's what's really nice. And in this day of busyness, it's quite nice to get something in a few lines capturing, and that's a challenge in itself. For those people that have written them, for it to be in the booklet that it's in, it's great. I'm just regretting that I didn't enter one myself. But, I mean, being the judge, obviously, that wouldn't have been fair.
I thought it'd be a good idea to write a limerick for a bookmark, and the construction of this was obviously, you know, bookmark being a literary programme. I thought, well, it has to revolve around that. Now, it might be that when I've read it, the word abstruse will stick in your mind. Abstruse, which I had to look up as well, meaning unclear or slightly hidden, and therefore maybe the little story in here is slightly hidden, but hopefully people will get it. So here goes. You may lean towards truth or perhaps fiction, engrossed in the author's depiction. As you cast yourself loose on journeys abstruse, let bookmark help feed that addiction.
And learn more about the competition at the website friendsofrockroadlibrary.wordpress.com. Our featured guests on Bookmark today are Judy and Adrian Ruth, talking about Act 3, The Art of Growing Older, published by Unbound. Judy and Adrian, Unbound, a crowdfunding platform and publisher. How have you found that experience? Kate Swindlehurst, who we talked to earlier, The Tango Effect, was published by Unbound, and I know she found it a bit of a hard slog at times.
Well, she's right. It is a hard slog. And I think in our situation, Act 3 and writing about it is such a new phenomena that there wasn't really a lot of evidence we could give to any publisher to say that we have many years' experience of helping people go through a really wonderful Act 3. What we do have is many years' experience of coaches and helping people from all walks of life to reimagine and then create the life that they really want to live. So we didn't have much to go on. I was, as you said, a published author, but trying to get a conventional publisher to take this on was not going to be that easy. So we went for Unbound, but certainly crowdfunding, going around everybody you've ever met and asking them to pay up front for your book, is a very unsettling experience. I'm not sure I'd have the stomach for it again. But on the other hand, it does give you more control as an author. And certainly from our side, writing it together, you've already got two opinions. We both have quite strong minds when it comes to what we think works and what we don't want in things. So having a bit more control as an author did help, certainly.
And they gave us fantastic editorial input.
And so what's next for you now?
Well, we're really enjoying, over these weeks of lockdown, doing these live Zoom meetings. Oh, we've had 70, 80 people come on the call each week, and we'll probably carry on because lockdown isn't going to finish overnight. There's possibility of a podcast, not sure yet. And also speaking at festivals.
The other thing is that we've done a number of Guardian masterclasses on Act 3. That, of course, is all on hold at the moment, but they are planning their digital version of the same. So hopefully that will emerge soon. And when we can get back to meeting human beings again, then we'll carry on running workshops and weekends about Act 3, because it's lovely being in a room with people. I mean, it's great to write a book about it, but it's lovely being face-to-face with real people and able to facilitate, be a catalyst in them coming to a good place with their stuff. That's really what we're about.
Oh, it's great, Mark. I thoroughly recommend it. Act 3, The Art of Growing Older. And question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've always got about four books on the go. One I listen to, one by my bed, one on my desk, and one floating somewhere. But I've been meaning to read this for years and years and years, and I'm really enjoying I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. I've cried, I've laughed, and been in complete and utter awe of the kind of life she was subjected to, particularly as a young child. And so I'm really enjoying that one. And yeah, various other things, because I'm on a writing course as well. So we get a long reading list.
I'm in a sort of, I almost describe it as Biggles with sails. I'm reading Captain Hornblower, C.S. Forrester's series about Napoleonic wars on ships. And so it's all flapping sails and avast behind and, you know, splice the main brace, all that kind of stuff. It's wonderful escapism from where we are thinking about viruses. So I'm enjoying that.
Well, thank you very much. We'll come back to you in a moment just to hear your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show, our featured guest will be Azadeh Moaveni, talking about her book, Guest House for Young Widows Among the Women of ISIS. We'll hear from Cheryl Misak on her biography of mathematician and economist Frank Ramsey called A Sheer Excess of Powers. And Peter Morfoot will be talking about Knock 'em Dead, the latest in his Captain Darek series of crime novels. But we'll sign out with your last choice of music, Judy and Adrian, which is the Bee Gees and Staying Alive. Very upbeat. Why this one?
Well, why wouldn't you want to stay alive? It's great.